Welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine publishes original crime and mystery short stories, and in our podcast series, we present readings of stories from our back issues. Most of our stories are read by the authors themselves, but in this episode, our managing editor, Jackie Sherbo, reads Angela Zeman's story, The First Tale of Roxanne, from our May 2013 issue. I don't think Angela Zeman intended to start a series when she wrote this historical, but we were so taken with it, we begged her for more. And late last year, in our September-October 2019 issue, we were fortunate to publish The Second Tale of Roxanne. It's with a heavy heart that I tell you that Angela died earlier this year as we were putting this podcast together. Angela published her first short story in our pages in 1993 with The Witch and the Fishmonger's Wife, featuring the beguiling Mrs. Risk, who was also featured in her 2001 novel, The Witch and the Borscht Pearl. And now, The First Tale of Roxanne.
Roxanne presented the small, worn scroll with both hands, eyes lowered. Her husband had instructed her, before their so-called wedding festivities, to never look directly at him. After a few sharp slaps, the cramped posture had become second nature. She supposed it was intended to make her superior height less annoying, but she wasn't sure, as so much about her annoyed him. She was tall for a woman, and Festus Umbertus Depilus, though powerfully built, was short for a man. He accepted the scroll as if it were a temple offering and he, a long-suffering, underserved god. His usual manner. "Where'd you get this?" Depilus's tone was irritable. He pushed away his breakfast bowl of figs, shuddering, appetite awry from his prior evening's indulgences at a fellow merchant's dinner party. He pressed hairy-knuckled fingers to his brow. "A messenger brought it, husband." A strand of silvery blonde hair slipped from her hairpins. She suppressed a sigh and decided to wait to repair her coif. Her fumbles usually annoyed him further. Even after 8 months in Rome, she still despaired to master the Roman manner of hairdressing. Scythian styles had tended more towards braids, far easier, in her opinion. Depilus Umbertus shifted his thick shoulders as if his tunic scratched, which it might well have. August in Rome was not a comfortable month, especially for one approaching his 40th year with a long habit of self-indulgence. "A scroll for you?" he barked, then winced at the noise. She pressed her slender arms tight to her sides as if trying to shrink within her peach-tinted draperies. "I was surprised, too," Depilus snorted. "Who'd write you?" "I can only suppose my brother?" Depilus looked up in surprise. "You have a brother?" She flushed. "Well, the messenger said he'd come by way of Athens. When I was captured and enslaved," she omitted mentioning, Depilus had purchased her specifically for marriage, but resented that he'd acquired his wife through the slave trade and hated any reminder. "My brother had just left for Athens to find work." She ventured a peek at her husband. He seemed only puzzled, not angry. Relieved, she continued. "We're orphans. Who else would write me? My fate would be no secret. He could have made inquiries. Would you please read it to me, husband? I'm most anxious to learn what he writes." "I'm busy." He stood, thrust the scroll into his leather pouch with other documents, and strode brusquely from the house. They lived in a newly replastered townhouse off a small byway at the foot of the Aventine Hill, the 13th district. Not the best class of neighborhood in Rome, but a good starter location for an ambitious man. Depilus, an importer of iron and pewter kitchenware from Britain and salted fish from Greece, aspired to invade the salons of society with increasingly finer, more expensive, household goods and rarer, more profitable, nibbles. His burgeoning prosperity testified to his business acumen. His need to resort to the slavers for a wife testified to his charms. 8 months earlier, he'd spotted Roxanne among the latest batch of slaves brought in from Roman skirmishes in Scythia. Despite grime and bruises, her graceful manner, willowy form, and sheet of silky pale blonde hair had dazzled him. Her facility with his language, foreign to her, affirmed a mental competence. A crude inspection assured him of her youth. She had similarly attracted other bidders, so she cost him dearly, but upon the slaver's insistence that her virginity had been safeguarded, a clean Depolis insisted on ratifying before payment. It was too soon to regret his investment. Slaves could never marry, so he immediately freed her and made her his wife. Rome was a progressive city where such events could happen without prejudice. On the same evening, after the scroll arrived, after a meal of cold chicken and chopped olives on crusty bread, Roxanne refilled Depolis's wine cup for a third time, then resumed her couch across the table. They dined, as many Romans did in the warm months, in their roof garden, seeking cool breezes and enjoying the stars. After she observed Depolis take a deep gulp of wine, she asked in a timid voice, "Did you find a moment today to read my scroll, husband?" Depolis nodded, studiously avoiding looking at her. "Oh, yes, it was as you said. If your brother's name is Adelphus Xanthus," he snorted his disdain. Roxanne clasped her hands tightly. "Yes, well, no, but it's the name he told me he would take for his work. Our syllables are difficult for others to pronounce. Did he speak of his purpose in writing me?" Her pale face glowed with eagerness in the torchlight. Depolis eyed her in suspicion. "You're quite excited about this. Well, he wants to visit you. Does he think I'm willing to board him? I didn't buy this house to fill it with your leeching relatives." She stood and leaned over the parapet to gaze in the lights lining the Tiber River's edge. "Husband, console yourself. There are no more. He's all I've got." Depolis grumbled to himself, then said, "He can stay a few days." She turned and curtsied. "Stop that," he commanded. "It's not appropriate for a Roman." "Yes, of course." As she began gathering empty dishes onto a tray, she added, "You're very patient with me, husband, and most kind to read my letter, and kindest of all to allow me a reunion with my beloved brother." She dared to let her eyes meet his for a moment, her blue eyes large and liquid, charming him into temporary speechlessness. As she balanced the heavy tray to begin her descent down the stone steps, Depolis recovered his wits. He barked, "Here, get yourself a household slave for hauling trays. I can't risk you taking a tumble down the staircase. You might get yourself barren." The kitchen was on the lowest level of the narrow house's four floors, making for a tight squeeze and a long journey. Roxanne maneuvered the tray to settle more firmly on one shoulder. "I'm happy to serve you, dear husband." He blustered, "Oh, you'll still work. One slave only. Damned if you'll laze around here like a whore. You're a Roman matron now, not a..." He stopped in confusion. "I expect heirs of you," he finished in triumph. A tiny smile tugged at her lips. "An excellent point, husband. You're right, as always." She and the tray disappeared down the stairs. The next evening, he presented her with a cheap, hammered copper bangle. She praised it with delight until he lost interest. In September, hurrying to get her shopping home before the day's heat became unbearable, she collided with the sturdy back of a man in a brown tunic who had veered into her path. Her basket tipped and the groceries tumbled out. "Great Zeus!" she exclaimed as tomatoes burst on the filthy pavement. Onions whirled under the trampling feet of the crowds. More bloody trouble. The jostled man turned in surprise. Both stooped to retrieve melons, grapes, and sundry vegetables. A large codfish had escaped from its paper wrapping and lay on the hot pavement. "Oh no," she moaned. "It was expensive." She brushed it dirt, and no doubt worse, sticking to the still damp scales. He chuckled. "Oh, just rinse it off. Your husband's taste buds will never know. Next time, bring household help. That basket was far too overloaded for a woman." Distracted from the fish, she glared at him. "I managed fine until you blocked my way." "You came at me from behind," he pointed out. "You stepped in my path." They straightened to face each other. He stood his ground against the crowds, which pelted around them without pause. "Then I humbly beg pardon, Madame Roxanne." She stared. He was tall enough so that her nose came only to his shoulder. He had the hardened body and permanent tan of a soldier who'd campaigned too many years in a southern climate. His arms, chest, and long legs burst with muscles that were scored with a dozen scars, which she could see because his tunic was so short, covered only the decencies. His dark eyes squinted steadily into her icy blue ones with a solemnity that she suspected concealed laughter. Laughter at her? She bristled. How do you know my name? He tilted his head, grinning openly now. Gaius Aelianus Verinus, ma'am. Ex-legionary, Roman army. Captain over the vigils of the fourth cohort. Appointed just before last Saturnalia, a few weeks before you arrived, which happened to be just after Saturnalia. Her lips tightened. So observant, you make me feel safe. Kind of you, but a lady of your visage will be noticed wherever you go. She exhaled in exasperation. My misfortune. He lifted the half-emptied basket from her arm, then bent to retrieve the vegetables still untrammeled. He plucked a thick marrow from the nuzzling of a passing goat. Nice produce. The shopkeepers must also appreciate your... He shot her a teasing glance. Your visage. She stiffened. Really, you go too far. My mother would agree. She says the army has not improved me, nor has age. He sighed contentedly. Pardon my low manner. I meant only that the market vendors, the fishmonger and Roscus, the baker especially, are addled by your amiable nature. One of your type. Type of what? She demanded. Beauty, madam. I meant only that when a lady is so perfectly lovely as you, with such graceful manners and noble speech, she does not usually stoop to friendly chat with the bakery staff and the like, as they wear out my ears telling me. Roxanne swiped at a strand of hair sticking to her perspiring forehead. Oh, could you not just go away? As watch captain, I'm responsible for my citizens. Perhaps a bit overly protective. A fond father. He smiled ruefully. When allowed to be home, and not on some foreign march. Inform your husband that, in the East, peacock blue color has become the latest fad in dining accessories. She hesitated, then asked, You know my husband? Festus Umbertus Depilus, importer of pans and fish paste. Half of Rome knows Depilus, the kitchen staffs anyway, and wine shops. She looked at him uncertainly. How kind. I'll tell him what you said of the peacock color. Will he know your name? Verinus grinned cheerfully. Doubtful. Hope you'll remember it, though. Verinus. Known to be dependable in a crisis. Your fishmonger can vouch for that. She took her basket from him and gazed, dismayed at the reduced contents. Well, thank you, I suppose. Brows furrowed, she turned to continue home. Later, as Verinus had assured her, Depilus ate the fish without comment about the fish. When he'd emptied his platter, he shoved it away and leaned on his elbow. He peered up at her, head lowered like a cantankerous bull. You don't like your own cooking? She started nervously. She had been caught in a deep study of the darkening sky. Night was arriving earlier now. The breezes were freshening. No, husband. I eat, but now I am busy serving. Would you like more wine? You're thinning down, hardening, not as... He searched for words. Not as rounded as you used to be. Where's the slave I authorized you to purchase? I'm tired of your constant bustle. Like living with a wretched broom. Roxanne said, flustered, I forgot about the slave. My thoughts have been too full with happiness over my brother. Well, keep your mind on me and your duty. Depilus pursed his thick lips and dabbed olive oil from them with a soft linen napkin, one of a set he'd brought home from his warehouse, a luxury item recently added to his inventory. He examined the grease stain on it proudly. Very fine, these. Yes, your brother, he added irritably. What's the news on that subject? Where is this fellow? How old is he anyway? Younger? Older than you? My twin husband, Roxanne said mildly. I am anxious also. Did he mention his letter when he expected to arrive? Depilus slapped a hand at her. Who remembers? My mind is busy with more important matters than when a freeloader will arrive on my doorstep. I'm sure he would work, husband. He is very skilled. Depilus looked up in surprise. Skilled? At what? As a secretary, he can read and write in three languages. And, she added eagerly, he is shrewd at accounting. Useful. Unlike you, sadly, for my bank account. Your price threatens to outstrip your value. Roxanne looked at her hands. Yes, husband, I am nothing like as smart as my brother. Depilus drained his wine cup. I meant fertile. Maybe I can use him in the business, then. He looked at her suspiciously. He's not escaped from somewhere. Don't involve me in any legal wrangles. He's a free man, husband, she said meekly, to the best of my knowledge. Depolis shrugged. Well, good. He might as well work for me. Write up my foreign contracts. The better to keep my private business private, in the family. He grimaced, eyeing her with distaste. So to speak. As a free man, he would expect pay, husband, she said. He expects to live under my roof, too. Depolis stood, swaying. He tottered toward the stairs. Places to be. He sneezed, then warbled to her. Don't wait up. Roxanne, who'd begun gathering dirty plates, called after him, Enjoy yourself, husband. Words she said more and more frequently these days. You work so hard. You deserve to play. She kept her tone bright. Now it was October, but still warm enough for Depolis to prefer dining on the roof. Roxanne darted up and down the stairs without pause, her errands seemingly endless as she laid out dishes and filled bowls. Her husband frowned at her. Wife. Roxanne paused, startled. A second scroll arrived this morning. He smacked the thin roll onto the table. For you. She approached it, wide-eyed. From my brother? Oh, please read it to me. He unrolled it. Again, the scroll looked dirty and frayed, as if it had traveled a long distance and been handled roughly. Depolis stared at the curling parchment, then began, tone studiedly casual. Dearest sister, I hope this finds you well. My apologies for the length of time. Depolis stopped, color rising up in his jowls. He resumed, but Roxanne noticed that his eyes did not glide along the words. Before my promised arrival at the mansion of Umbridus Depolis, my work required me to travel an unexpected distance, taking more time. I will, must ask you. Depolis let the scroll snap shut. He waved his hand carelessly. His job delays him. A detour to Gaul. Roxanne studied him. When he glared up at her, his face now deep puce, she swiftly dropped her gaze. Thank you for reading it, husband. I'm relieved to learn he is safe and well, only delayed. Yes, Depolis shrugged. He poured himself more wine, drank, then wiped his mouth on his tunic sleeve. Sir, may I? She tried to hand him a small bowl of water to rinse his fingers. His latest import, thin pottery ware, glazed a green shade he called basil. He'd invented a range of herbal names for the colors, to entice housewives to buy multiple sets. He slapped away her hand. The little bowl crashed into shards on the tile. He roared, Skinny as a stick, and not pregnant. 10 months I've had you. He stood, knocking back his chair. Without protest, she allowed him to pull her roughly to a spare couch. As he rutted, she stroked his thick neck while crooning soothing syllables and gazing determinedly at the stars. By early November, Roxanne now pursued her tasks of shopping, cooking, and cleaning at a brutal pace. Her body had become gaunt with stringy muscles, her breasts flat, and her complexion ghostly. Depolis ignored her now, disappearing sometimes for entire days, often returning like a pile of dirty laundry in a cheap hired chair. Then Roxanne had to dig in his clothing for sesterces to bribe the carriers to help her haul him inside. He would vomit and piss in random corners, but she mopped up after him without a word. By the nones of November, she had not bled for 6 weeks. Normally, her body performed with strict adherence to the moon cycle. Exactly on the Ides, after noontime, when the streets were less crowded and most market stalls shuttered, she fastened her money purse on a string around her neck. She wrapped herself in a long hooded cloak over 2 thick shawls and left her house. She hurried along the embankment, darting nervous glances at the churning, muddy Tiber waters. She crossed a bridge, then plunged into the 14th district, the Trans-Tiberina. She pulled the hood of her cloak as low as possible, not daring to hamper her vision too much in this dangerous part of Rome. The streets narrowed and became increasingly cluttered with dung and garbage and small, dead animals, she hoped. For the first time since she'd lost all her body fat, she felt gratitude for the cold. It slowed decomposition and kept the air at least breathable. Clutches of rats merely spared her a glance before continuing their feasts, as if assessing, then dismissing her as a possible additional snack. Shivering dogs snarled, but stayed huddled in their warmer holes and doorways. She averted her gaze from these sights as much as she could while keeping her feet steady. To trip and fall into this swill was too appalling a prospect. The few other pedestrians out on a mean day like this had also bundled themselves up. Once in a while, someone would roughly bump her, causing her to stagger. She caught herself gasping for breath, fear making her claustrophobic. She had tucked a kitchen knife into her girdle, but wondered how fast she could get to it under her cloak and shawls. A half mile farther, she veered into a byway too insignificant to bear a finger post, which led into ever-deepening shadows that made the chill air even more cruel to her skin. There she found a cherry-red doorway that seemed to pulse in the dim light. She tapped rapidly 3 times, and the door swung open. An hour later, she stepped gingerly back over the lintel, back into the noxious alley in the direction from which she'd come. This time, she walked slower, with distraction, no longer seeming to care when rude strangers jostled her. Retracing her path, she eventually reached her own door, but passed it to pay a late visit to the market stalls, which had reopened by now. She purchased 2 soft rolls of bread and a meager chicken for the evening meal. Then, after a moment's long consideration, she also purchased a scrap of ragged parchment, a square of solid ink, and a quill. Nothing expensive, but she could not think of what else her brother might want. At the last second, she saw a tunic dyed a dim red. "Remember Saturnalia, my lady," cried the clothing merchant, "only weeks away. For you, I willingly sacrifice profit. Surely you have a favorite servant to spoil." With no decorative braid or stripes, and obviously second-hand, it would be appropriate for a poor clerk. She touched it with her work-roughened fingers. The merchant noticed. "Yes, worn a few times, but that only softens a good cloth like this. Still enough color to make it festive." She bargained routinely, added it to her parcels, then turned for home to begin supper. That night, she waited until her husband had drunk 2 full beakers of hot spiced wine before she spoke. She made sure he had a bowl of olives within reach, then returned to her stool. They dined in their regular dining room now that November had brought early nights and low temperatures. Tonight she had piled the hearth unusually high with branches, adding apple twigs to perfume the room. The fire crackled. Wind gusts down the chimney made sparks flare and red and gold lights dance on the undecorated walls. She cleared her throat, which failed to attract her husband's notice as he dug at an olive stone wedged in his teeth. Finally, she spoke. "Depolis?" His head jerked up. She had never used his name to him before. "What?" Slowly, she lifted her head to meet his eyes. A forbidden act, but a month ago, she'd cut the legs of her stool lower than his, so her daring was somewhat tempered. "Husband, I am with child." His brow furrowed. "I don't believe you. You don't even cast a shadow. If you carried anything in your pocket, it would show, never mind a bump in your belly." Her smile trembled. "I consulted a midwife today. She was most thorough in her examination." Depolis stared suspiciously, lips parted, but making no sound. Then, "You heard in the forum that I seek divorce." Roxanne smiled, shook her head. "I hadn't heard that, no." He shrugged. "Not true anyway, needless expense. You're withering so fast, I figure you'll move to the next world before spring. Whatever afterworld barbarians go to." He laughed heartily at his joke. She waited. Finally, "You are pregnant? Really?" She nodded, her smile more confident now. Depolis stood abruptly. "By Jupiter, I hardly know. I'd given up. To think. Me. A father. An heir. Did the midwife say it was a boy?" Roxanne lowered her eyes. "It is early. When I visit her next, she said she could tell me then." Depolis strode to her and snatched her up in his arms. She laughed uneasily. "Take care, husband. You are too strong. I'm in a fragile state." He hurriedly released her. Oh yes, you must rest. I'll bring you cushions from the warehouse tomorrow and servants." He gazed around as if he'd just woken from a dream. "Where in Hades is that slave of yours?" "Oh, husband, I never found one. Bah, forget it. I'll fetch home an entire staff for you first thing tomorrow. A cook, a household slave, a porter too. You must not carry things anymore. He will carry." Depolis took a deep, relieved breath. "Oh, I am giddy." "Go to your friends, husband. You work hard. You deserve to let them congratulate you." He considered her through the shrubbery of his eyebrows. "It will be an heir? A boy?" "Oh, surely," she said in a teasing, affectionate tone. "What else would a virile man like you produce? Maybe twins. I'm a twin, remember. It is said to run in families." He laughed loudly, then paced the room. "Tomorrow, we go around to make the sacrifices. Never risk the jealousy of the gods, and I've been too lucky for a mortal man. But tonight, I..." Roxanne leaped to her feet. "The weather is harsh tonight. Let me fetch you your..." He grabbed her elbows and steered her to a couch. "I'll get my own cloak. Rest, wife, and eat. You'll need bigger breasts than those to suckle a son of mine. He chuckled to himself as he left the room. As he exited, she heard him exclaim to himself, "To think, I had already forfeited my investment in my mind." The door slammed. Roxanne stayed quietly by the fire. After a while, the heat crept comfortably into her bones. She leaned her head back against the bare wall and, miraculously, dozed. An hour later, a frantic pounding at the door roused her. She flung open the door. "Larius, news?" The baker's 12-year-old son stood on her portico, water streaming over his bare head from the sheets of rain. "Lady Roxanne, it's happened, as you foretold." "A cargo ship? Foundered?" "Yes." He eyed her with wonder. "How did you know it would happen?" "What name?" "The Euphrates. From Gaul, they say. It is stranded on the Francium shelf in the bay. But a ferry is going out from Porta Marina, hoping to save the passengers and cargo." He repeated, perplexed. "How did you know?" She pulled him inside and shut the door. "When does the ferry embark?" "They hadn't even begun to fit up when I left. You know how it goes. Merchants and navy wrangle over salvage rights. Then the winner negotiates for extra fenders and towing tackle." Water pooled on the tiles at his feet. He was as drenched as if he'd swum to her door. Roxanne thrust a silver denarius into the boy's dripping hand. "You've been faithful. I will remember." Larius ducked his head, hiding his delight, and pushed the coin into a hidden pocket. "I have honey cakes for you. Remember your instructions and wait. Remember?" "I remember everything, lady. I'm to tell Umbertus Depilus." "Yes, yes," she exclaimed, hurrying to the kitchen. "The donkey?" "I hired the fastest one in Ostia, lady," he boasted shyly as he darted after her. "Brought me to you in a smashing race. He'll get you back even faster, I vow. All beasts want their homes, especially on nights like this." "You brilliant boy." Larius paused. "You sure you can manage as a strong beast in a foul night?" "Females are not such feeble creatures, dear Larius. To the fire, your father won't thank me if you catch cold." She filled a plate with his promised honey cakes, then snatched up a kitchen knife, which she thrust into her girdle on her way back to the hall. Roxanne plundered a closet beneath the stairs for her cloak, then grabbed a bulging sack tucked in the shadows. At the half-moon table near the door, she opened her sack. She quickly unspooled a worn parchment, spat on the square of dried ink, and, using her newly purchased quill, wrote the word Euphrates into a blank space left among other, already inscribed words. She replaced the writing tools in the bundle, tied its strings firmly to her belt, then left the scroll prominently displayed on the table. Wrapping her cloak around her, she fled. Less than 90 minutes later, Roxanne, bent close to the hard neck of her trotting mount, reached the end of Ostia's main highway. A few yards away, near invisible in the dark, Gaius Aelianus Varinus lazed casually on a bollard with the demeanor of taking a sunbath in the country. Impervious to the soaking he was getting, he chewed on a sassafras stem and watched sailors swarming over and around a fat dowager of a ferry boat, lashing bales of straw to its sides, fitting it out for their mission. Suddenly, he noticed Roxanne. Now on foot, she raced past without seeing him, toward the ferry, which tossed at its mooring. She shrieked through the howling storm at the sailors, a few of whom, somehow understanding her words, manhandled her aboard the bucking two-decked boat as if she were a large tuna. Varinus lunged to his feet and trotted to the pier, and, since the gangplank had just been pulled back, leapt. His long legs just managed the widening gap between pier and departing ferry. Clearing the spiky oars, he tumbled safely to the deck. Roxanne peered through the rain at this reckless arrival and gasped when she saw his face. "Bloody Hades." "Well said. Your vocabulary continues to delight." Varinus gazed admiringly into her face, then reflexively blocked her tumble overboard as the boat pitched in a new direction. He gripped her elbows and pulled her close. "I'd offer you a more secure niche, but the rescue tackle seems to be using all the space." Roxanne wrestled out of his embrace. "Watch yourself. Don't force me to call for a tribune." She mugged a mocking smile up at him, then staggered to grab a support post. She wrapped her arms around it. "Now I feel safe." She forgot him and stared bleakly into the heavy waves, the heights of which, in the gloom, could be judged only from the dips and sudden risings of the ragged line of oars. An overseer's hammer beat a monotonous rhythm below the random crashes and pounding rain. "Fine weather," Varinus frowned. "Why did they allow you to board? You're hardly an asset in deep water." Roxanne pushed ropes of sodden hair from her eyes. I paid for the privilege. Varinus's eyebrows lifted. Tepolis is so generous with your allowance. Roxanne glared. I'm thrifty. And you? He grinned. Been in the protection racket too long, I guess. Heard about the rescue. Couldn't stop myself. My brother. He's stranded on the Euphrates. I can't bear the idea that we might never... that I might never lay eyes on him again in this world. You could both perish. Roxanne shrugged, gazing into the heaving seas. Then we perish together. Better than just one of us. Is it so bad? Slavery? Separation from your brother. Tepolis is your family now. He freed you. You're a respectable Roman matron. Roxanne spat fiercely into the salt spray, which slapped her spittle back into her face, surprising her to laugh. Yes, he did, didn't he? She swung to face Varinus. But how free does a woman ever get, even in Rome? He said, you're an odd fish. She smiled. If so, I'm in my element. Can you swim? Well enough to earn my rank. He grinned. The army insists. Can you? No. They both glanced involuntarily at the black abyss beyond the heaving rail. As icy waves slapped at their thighs, she continued absently. I am with Depolis's child. Have you heard the joyous news? I err. He only learned it himself tonight. Oh-ho, that answers much. He's busy getting free drinks, and you've run out. He believes you safely home in bed. More than an odd fish, a slippery eel. Roxanne shrugged. He deserves to celebrate, as I often remind him. The good wife, his tone was mocking. But Roxanne's worries distracted her. Tomorrow, the shipping lanes will have closed. My brother delayed too long. But I've been at Isis's altar every day since he first wrote. Her terrified smile blazed up at him. Isis would not spurn such devotion. Mark me, this will end well. She groped away from him, pulling herself along from one deck support to another toward the bow. At the moment she found a hatch leading below decks, the torrents hardened to sleet. The oarsmen cried out fearfully as the pelting ice and the overseer's pounding pace increased. Bracing against the bitter gale, she pointed with agitation at the hatch cover. Obediently, Varinus groped his way forward to haul it open for her. He lifted her easily, then lowered her down to the arms of a sailor they'd intercepted on his way topside. Varinus jumped in after. Before the sailor could dart up the stairs, Varinus shouted at him, "What progress?" 20 minutes, Captain says. We don't see her by then. You'd turn back? We know the waters. Don't find her. She's sunk already. The sailor vaulted himself lightly up and through the gap. The wind slammed the hatch shut behind him. The noise suddenly muted to a roar. Complete darkness enveloped them. Roxanne's body trembled violently. Fumbling at the edges of her dripping cloak, she managed to wrap it tight around herself, an icy shroud. Moving in clumsy concert with the rolling hull, she shifted until she could brace against a built-in cabinet. There she huddled, clutching her knees, and stared into her own thoughts. Varinus finally spoke. They'll find him. Yes. 5 wordless minutes later, Varinus climbed topside, letting the hatch bang shut behind himself. Roxanne sat in agonized patience, listening. All around her in the blackness, creaking wood, groans of oarsmen, and the thundering hammer. The enraged seas trying to rip the old ferry apart. Roxanne thought she'd go deaf, but still strained for every sound. She fastened her thoughts on Isis, protector of travelers over water. She also judged the ferry as old and seasoned, not a race winner, but a relentless survivor of numberless battles with the sea. Only Neptune could overturn this woman. When the shouting started, Roxanne laughed. Following April, a clearly sullen Depolis trudged down the travertine path to the necropolis. His toga dragged in the dust. He'd paid an outrageous amount for the pewter-trimmed malachite urn lofted by 2 slaves rented for the procession. Roxanne's story had proved surprisingly interesting to the populace, and Depolis had had to factor publicity for his business into the funeral expenses. Still, only 2 professional mourners wailed, and no clowns. His insincerity balked at more trappings. He mourned, but not for Roxanne. The crazy wench had betrayed him. When she'd drowned in the Euphrates disaster, she'd taken his child with her. It was for his son, who might have been handsome and tall, a undoubtedly taller than Depolis, he mourned. It grated Depolis that he'd lost access to a female of Roxanne's caliber to bear his heirs. In middle-class salons, the eligible daughters parading past the suddenly romantically viewed tradesmen had so far been as short as he, and some of them as hairy. Even the slave pens behind the cattle forum yielded no such prize as Roxanne. Yet. Soon more raids would be launched into Scythia. Depolis could hardly wait. Also in the funeral train, head dipped in meek apology, all knew how he blamed himself. Roxanne's striking twin brother, Adelphus Xanthus, marched in staunch brotherly support of Depolis. Before abandoning hope that the spring currents might nudge Roxanne's corpse to the surface, society had had leisure to admire how he'd taken responsibility for his sister's shocking foolishness. When word spread of his pledge of 1 year of celibacy and sobriety in penitence for Depolis' double loss, he won widespread affection, even from the hordes who'd never met him. The palace had noticed the public's fondness for Adelphus Xanthus. Emperor Vespasian, known to reward talents who shared his middle-class virtues, appointed the abstemious penitent to a secretarial post. The job, in an office that monitored political affairs in far-flung posts, would have crowned years of prior promotions for most Romans. But Vespasian's favor, plus Xanthus' gift for languages, had clinched the job. His gleaming looks hadn't hurt. When the last of the funeral bustle had dissipated, a subdued Xanthus shunned the buffet and left his brother-in-law to the wine-soaked consolations of his friends. He threaded his way through back streets to his apartment, a walk-up permanently shadowed by the high back wall of a temple shrine to the Virgin Diana, a convenient stroll from the palace. He walked with his head bowed, deep in thought, which was undoubtedly the reason he collided with the broad back of a man in a brown tunic. Xanthus started, "Bloody Hades!" Varinus turned and smiled down at Xanthus, whose nose came only to Varinus's shoulder. Varinus parked ham-sized hands on his hips. "You curse like your twin. I mean, beg pardon, you look alike, which I suppose is usual for twins." He gave a short laugh. "Forgive me, haven't seen many twins in my life and travels." Xanthus considered. "Varinus, right? I've heard about you. And seen me bobbing about here and there, I don't doubt. You do seem to be in most places. An eerie effect. Works wonders on the nerves of criminals and escaped slaves." Varinus began strolling, so Xanthus joined him. Xanthus clasped his hands behind his back. "Sad business, funerals." Varinus grunted agreement. "Your sister told me she couldn't face living without you." "Please don't say that. I feel wretched enough." "But it's true. She risked her life to spend her last breath with you. If last breath it was to be. Gods knew. Rather that, she said, than to survive if you drowned. She swore to join you in the drowning, if Isis didn't lob you aboard that damned ferry." Xanthus glanced up curiously. "Damned? Why do you call it damned?" "It surrendered her to Neptune before you appeared. A few oarsmen drowned, no surprise, water up to their necks and chained to benches. And off the Euphrates, you survived, one of a plucky handful. But Roxanne..." Varinus paused, scratching at his furrowed brow. "How in Hades did she manage to wash over the side, from inside that cabin, deep in the hull of the ferry?" Xanthus stopped. "Oh, she must have come back up on deck, don't you see?" "I don't see. The wind was a hurricane. Well, you were there. She didn't like to ask favors. She'd make her independence plain since we first met. But just as plain, the hatch was thick Britannium oak, banded in iron. She asked for my help to open it, only from need. I even boosted her into the hold. Light as a twig, your sister." Varinus eyed Xanthus. "You too, I'd estimate." Xanthus bristled. "I'm as manly as you, if not as inflated." Varinus gave a short laugh, eyeing him. "She never lifted that hatch herself." Xanthus said in exasperation. "Then explain it." "If I could..." They resumed walking. "Even if I hadn't admired her sister so much, well, puzzles, they intrigue me." Xanthus said nothing. Varinus gazed ruefully at his companion. "I don't like to upset you on this day, Xanthus." "No, please, continue." "Well," Varinus sighed, "I'm a friendly sod, happy chatting up the shopkeepers in the market and such. The baker's son, Larius, he tossed me an interesting fable." "About Roxanne?" He claims Roxanne predicted the foundering of the Euphrates. I see why you call it a fable. Varinus nodded. Usually a reliable lad. Special friend of Roxanne's. Well, many liked her. He sighed. As did I. To my regret, I called her an odd fish near the end. Xanthus chuckled. She enjoyed being herself. I think she'd heard worse. Then I called her an eel. Together, they burst into laughter, but it was quickly gone. Sobering, Varinus continued. Remember Tepolis's tale of her visiting a midwife on the Ides? What of it? Varinus said, as it happened, Laria saw her cross the Probus Bridge, which gives only into the Trans-Tiberina. In that weather, that time of day? Varinus shook his head. He followed, anxious for her safety. He didn't recall it right away, unfortunately, dazed with heartbreak, but he's a sharp lad given enough time. See, he and I know no midwife operates in that appalling district. Customers wouldn't hire from there. No, midwives lean to the leafy suburbs. Gives an appearance of healthy living. Varinus sucked his teeth. Maybe that relieves your mind a bit. Xanthus stared. Varinus added, no visit to a midwife, see? Merely a ruse to get Depolis out of the house on a bad night. Xanthus said nothing. Varinus waved impatiently. No child. Depolis wasn't so cheated then. Xanthus exhaled. Ah, now I see what you mean. But shippers, the Trans-Tiberina might as well be labeled their headquarters. Not traditional tax diddlers like Depolis. Smugglers. Tuck a pouch of diamonds into an amphora of oil. Mislabel barrels of artifacts as olives. Stolen relics passed off as knickknacks. That kind of shipper. Xanthus said, not understanding your point. November weather is frightful. The first major storm closes the shipping lanes until the following season. As I know now, too well. Varinus grimaced. As do these smugglers. No ships, no profits. To squeeze goods into the harbor until the last second, they maintain an admirable network of informants, better than the Emperor's. Don't tell him that. On the Ides, the nervously awaited first bad storm arrived. Signals of its approach traveled faster. A bag of denarii could buy a harmless outsider. For instance, your worried sister. Such news. Varinus lifted a shoulder. I understand my sister's purse was kept light by her husband. Who'd given her money to purchase a slave? After a long moment, Varinus added, as for the baker's boy, Roxanne stopped at the bake shop on her way home. Larius thought she'd caught him tracking her, but she only set him to watch the port. He was to tip her the moment he learned of any sea rescue. As he did, your scroll named which ship you'd be on. To my sorrow. The two walked on in silence. Finally, Xanthus gestured. That's my place. I'd invite you in, but... Varinus grinned easily. No wine? I heard. Another time, when your sober year is up. Xanthus nodded. When my year is up. He and Varinus exchanged manly claps on shoulders, Varinus courteously holding back from injuring his companion. Xanthus veered to enter the archway to his staircase, when suddenly Varinus said, Oh, one last thing. Xanthus paused. Yes? Did you ever mention the peacock blue color to Depolis? Xanthus froze. Always wondered, because it never turned up on his lacquered bowl or tablecloths. A missed chance for him, that, wasn't it? He waited politely. Xanthus cleared his throat, but no words came. Varinus continued. Your sister said something of import that night, Xanthus. Its meaning came to me only gradually. What? Varinus smiled. She said, How free can a woman be, after all, even in Rome? Varinus ambled away.
That was Jackie Sherbo reading Angela Zeman's story, The First Tale of Roxanne, from our May 2013 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. If you've enjoyed listening to this story, you'll find many others from the magazine at our website, alfredhitchcockmysterymagazine.com. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published by Dell Magazines and Penny Publications. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital editions are available at all major e-tailers. This podcast was produced with the help of Ray Purdom and our managing editor, Jackie Sherbo. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.